Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 073089, United States of America, Appellant versus Gus Gardellini, also known as Carlos Gustavo Gardellini. Mr. Hockman for the appellant, Mr. Schertler for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Hockman, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, Nathan Hockman, Assistant Attorney General for the Tax Division on behalf of the United States. I'll be reserving 2 minutes for rebuttal. Probation in Belgium. The sentence of probation in Belgium sends an unmistakable message to taxpayers that they can commit not just misdemeanors, but felony violations of our nation's tax laws. That they can do this not just for 1 or 2 years, but for 4 years. That they can fail to report their offshore bank account not just once, but every time. That they can underreport their income not just by thousands of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars, but by hundreds of thousands of dollars. That they can fail to pay their tax, not just thousands of dollars of tax or tens of thousands, but almost $100,000 of tax. That they cannot voluntarily disclose their crime when they get a pang of conscience or some remorse, but wait 5 years until the IRS catches them.
Well, that'd be a bad move to think that, because other district judges may impose above-guideline sentences.
Other district judges may. But the point is,
the whole point after Gaul is different district judges are going to do things differently.
But to the extent that the court, this D.C. Circuit, affirms a sentence like this, and in essence says that this sentence is substantively reasonable, that message is being sent certainly throughout this circuit, that if you're a dishonest taxpayer weighing the consequences of your actions, that you can do all this felonious conduct involving...
What about an ecstasy dealer in Gaul who got probation?
Well, again, the ecstasy...
What message did it send when the Supreme Court affirmed that sentence is substantively reasonable?
When the Supreme Court affirmed Gaul, it weighed a variety of factors, none of which applied to this case. It said, in essence, that if you turn around your life, and it viewed turning around your life as a very important factor, it viewed withdrawing from the conspiracy before any contact with law enforcement. It viewed the age. In that case, it was a 21-year-old as opposed to a 37-year-old here. It viewed this constellation of factors and said that in that case, actually giving something beyond probation would not show respect for the law, one of the four aims of sentencing. Here, a probation in Belgium shows complete disrespect for the law. It promotes disrespect from the law from honest taxpayers who are trying to contemplate and say, on April 15th, I got to put the resources in, I got to write the check, but this guy, who can do 4 years of felony violations, he gets probation in Belgium? And that's the honest taxpayer. The dishonest taxpayer is thinking consequences. What are the consequences of my actions? And if I can do all this conduct and wait till the IRS catches me, and by the way, not even pay the tax back until eight years after it's due, and all I get is probation in Belgium?
Your brief was puzzling to me in its stress on Belgium and yeah. and the assumed luxury of life in Belgium. I've been in Belgium. I mean, it didn't seem so wonderful to me.
It's not the luxury in life in Belgium. It's the unsupervised position of where Belgium is. That's the focus of Belgium. It could be any country outside the United States. But when Gaul talked about probation being almost equivalent in some ways to incarceration, what the court was basically saying is that there's a substantial restriction of liberty. Those are the actual words it uses, a substantial restriction of liberty. That assumes that a probation officer, as in Gaul, can make, for instance, an unannounced house visit.
So you'd be okay with probation in the United States?
What we're arguing in this case, Your Honor, is absolutely probation in Belgium or outside the United States is substantively unreasonable.
What's the answer to the question, though?
The answer to the question, Your Honor, is that we believed that a sentence within the advisory range between the 10 and 16 months was the reasonable sentence under the totality of circumstances in this case.
I'm glad you used the word advisory, because that's the point now, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Advisory. The advisory means the district court doesn't need to follow it.
Correct. Advisory means that the district court must consider it. And to the extent that there's any deviation from the guideline range, there has to be a sufficiently compelling justification for that to the extent of the deviation. Here you're going from incarceration not to a halfway house, not to home detention, not even to community service, but probation that is effectively unsupervised probation outside this country. For that type of extreme, we would say, deviation, along that entire totality, to go from one end to the other, the justification that the court used was that this defendant, quote, and this is in the written submission that the judge actually wrote out, suffered greatly as a result of the criminal investigation and prosecution. But the judge didn't identify anything more than the typical defendant who suffers. This defendant had sought psychological counseling in 2006. When he committed the crime in 98 to 2001, he found out about the IRS investigation in 2002. He was contacted by the IRS in 2004. In 2005, he actually went in. And then in 2006, he sought psychological counseling. The stress, his mother died apparently in 1995. He turns to alcohol when he goes down to Miami and befriends his alcoholic buddies in Miami from 98 to 2000. He wasn't suffering from alcoholism. He was voluntarily unemployed at the time. He was a primary caregiver of his child, so he didn't lose his job. He didn't lose his reputation. It's not like he had a law license or a medical license to lose. He didn't lose that. He had an MBA that he could fall back on. So in saying that this is the only justification to say he suffered greatly as a result of the criminal investigation and prosecution and therefore should get probation in Belgium or outside this country, we would say that this falls outside of the range of reasonable sentences. That's the word that they use in Cutler.
Is there a procedural violation claim nested within your substantive unreasonableness claim?
No, Your Honor.
No.
This claim is we are using substantive reasonableness. The judge considered the factors. He gave voice to the factors.
I thought that a major point you were making was that the judge explicitly and deliberately discounted any deterrence value.
Well, again.
So that at least that would seem to leave open the possibility of his correcting that and then rethinking the matter.
We would say, submit, Your Honor, that the judge gave lip service to deterrence. In fact, he said effectively that the sentence, and this is why it's substantively unreasonable, he said the sentence imposed does not deter. The prosecution and the efforts of an assistant United States attorney is what deters in this case, quote unquote. So we would say that the judge, in essence, that the nature of that is that the judge did not follow the legitimate aim of sentencing under 3553A2, that says you must afford adequate deterrence as a result of the sentence.
Are you saying that it's clear that if the judge on a remand straightened out his discussion of deterrence, he would absolutely have to impose prison time?
He would have to do something other than probation in Belgium, Your Honor. Whether it's prison time or some combination of prison with halfway house, which is, or a home detention, which is sort of the 5-5 split that you can get in a zone C sentence, or something along those lines. The one thing we're absolutely saying.
I think your answer was yes to Judge Williams' question.
The answer is yes with a caveat. So yes, the judge absolutely should impose prison or some combination of these other factors.
At least something mildly custodial.
Mildly restrictive, mildly answering the Gall question of substantial restriction on liberty. Absolutely. We would submit that the judge absolutely must impose some substantial restriction on liberty. And where in that gamut it is would be up to the judge to decide.
Are there no reporting requirements? He can stay in Belgium for the entire period?
Absolutely, Your Honor. He can stay in Belgium for the entire period. He can call in or mail in his forms once a month. There's no way to check on him at all. So, yeah, Your Honor, unless the court has any questions at this point, I would submit the rest of the time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is David Schirdler, and I represent the appellee in this case. For a change, Gus Gardellini. It's a nice feeling. Members of the panel, what the government is asking you to do here is engage in precisely the type of virtual de novo review of the district court sentencing decision that the Supreme Court has come out and said you cannot do. Gall and Kimbrough, Mr. Hochman's argument, I think, is a great argument before the trial court. But Gall and Kimbrough have brought, I think, a sea change in the landscape of federal sentencing. They have given the trial court much broader discretion in terms of what factors the trial court can rely upon in making its sentencing.
Are you going so far as to say that the post-Gall deterrence can be totally disregarded, notwithstanding the statute?
No, Your Honor, I would not say that. And that's not what the court did here. The court did discuss deterrence. And I think Mr. Hochman has, not intentionally, of course, but misstated the record. What the court said is, in this case, Mr. Gardellini's case is not going to get a lot of publicity. It's not going to be in the newspaper.
Are you really supporting that theory? So that you have two offenses and offenders, Martha Stewart and someone who duplicates what she did, and Martha Stewart has the book thrown at her and the other one walks because of the difference in publicity. You going to defend that?
Yes, Your Honor.
You are?
Yes. Okay. And I would, because I think what Kimbrough in particular says is there are a lot of factors that a district court can consider in fashioning the appropriate sentence. And there's no, I think Kimbrough also recognizes, and Judge Kavanaugh, I think you recognize this in a recent opinion of yours, that what we have, the price for the remedy that the Supreme Court has set out now is that there will be some disparity in sentencings. That is the cost of what the Supreme Court has told us we're going to do. And when you're talking about deterrence, Judge Williams, I think one of the things that a court has to consider is the publicity that's attendant to the case, because that is directly impacted on the deterrent effect. And in this case, this is a small-time tax case. Mr. Gardellini's case involved a relatively small amount of tax loss. It had occurred long in the past. It came to light as a result of a much larger investigation into a gentleman named Walter Anderson. It wasn't going to get any publicity, and I think the court appropriately, and this is where I think we have to give the district court discretion, but he appropriately said, look,
I mean, the huge majority of cases don't get significant publicity. So your argument, in effect, is that except in the rare case, deterrence should be disregarded altogether.
Well, see, Judge Williams, I don't think that's quite what I'm saying. Obviously, we're looking at every case, every offense differently, every defendant differently, and that's what Gall and Kimbrough tell us we have to do. But I don't think it's inappropriate for the district court in this case to say, look, this is a small-time tax case, the amount of loss is small, the guideline range is very low, and I don't think that we're going to have a lot of deterrent of value because Gus Gardellini is not going to be on the front page. But what the trial court did say is what is of a deterrent value are the efforts of the prosecution in going after people like Mr. Gardellini, and that's absolutely true.
If they just get a slap on the wrist, it's not that deterrent. I mean, I understand that he's marked as a felon, but beyond that, there's really not much.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that the deterrent effect on Mr. Gardellini or other people would be much greater given the a guideline sentence in this case as opposed to the probationary sentence. What you have to recognize is that the departure in this case was minimal. Mr. Gardellini was at a very low guideline range, 10 to 16 months. The court could have imposed five months of incarceration followed by 5 months of home confinement. The amount of departure from that point to probation, I would submit in the scheme of our federal criminal tax laws, is very low. So if you start with
this case suggests the problem that generated the guidelines in the first place, that white-collar defendants are going to get very light sentences.
No. Judge Kavanaugh, I would disagree with that because I think what I have, I don't think it's limited to white-collar defendants. Obviously, it may be, it will be applied in white-collar cases, but the case, first of all, the case that you cited, Gall, is a case involving a drug dealer. Kimbrough was, I believe, also a drug case. The cases that we had filed in our Rule 28 letter involved child pornography, and the departures in those cases were tremendously large. So I think what we've seen is that it's not being applied disproportionately in white-collar cases. It's being applied across the board in all kinds of cases. I think you're going to see it more in drug cases, in child pornography cases, where I think there's a perception among federal judges that the guidelines go too far and the sentences are too severe in those cases.
I'm not sure how that cuts. I mean, you're arguing for a reduction from what you already identify as a rather mild penalty.
Yes.
Is there any, or to what extent in other crimes, with respect to other crimes, did the guidelines specifically point out the problem of the comparative rarity of actually catching a violator, which they did in the introductory commentary for the tax provisions? Do you want me to read it to you?
Would you, Judge? I'm not sure I follow.
The criminal tax laws are designed to protect the public interest in preserving the integrity of the nation's tax system. Criminal tax prosecutions serve to punish the violator and promote respect for the tax laws. Because of the limited number of criminal tax prosecutions relative to the estimated incidence of such violations, deterring others from violating the tax laws is a primary consideration underlying these guidelines.
Judge Williams, I know that that's true in every case. That's true in every kind of criminal category you can imagine.
The tax laws are perhaps rare in that the whole system depends on the responsibility of people, and except for things that are clearly covered by 1099s and W-2s and so forth, the opportunity for fraud is great. And so the probability of catching people has got to be, as a practical matter, very low.
First of all, I'm not sure that I have statistics or the government's proffered statistics in this case.
The commission seemed to view it that way.
The commission undoubtedly viewed it that way, but I can guarantee you that there are more drug dealers walking on the streets dealing drugs than there are who have been caught, prosecuted, and put in jail. The same is true of Ponzi schemes or government contracting fraud.
The contention of the commission here is that there's a huge discrepancy between the estimated violations and the actual convictions.
And I don't know that I would disagree with that, but I don't see that that's significantly different from any other type of crime that we're dealing with.
To go back to my original question, you can't identify any other crime or set of crimes with respect to which the commission said something parallel to this.
No, sir, I can't. I would like to, I think one point I'd like to make before I...
By the way, I'm not sure this matters, but in the original sentencing here, there was no Sixth Amendment problem with how, if the guidelines had been mandatory, there would be no Sixth Amendment problem with how this was done, right?
If the guidelines were mandatory?
Were mandatory and the sentencing proceeded and followed the guidelines and imposed a sentence within the guidelines range, would there have been a Sixth Amendment problem?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so.
It just shows the mismatch, I suppose, between the violation and the remedy in Booker. But
I would like to say that I think the government misstates the basis upon which the district court did base its decision. It did not base its decision on the fact that Mr. Gardellini was a white-collar criminal, and it did not rely on the suffering that the court believed Mr. Gardellini had sustained during the course of the investigation. After refusing to depart downward within the guideline calculation, the district court clearly stated, the court then is left to consider the U.S. sentencing guidelines in connection with the other things which the court must consider as set forth in 183553. The court then goes on to say, and this is at page 126 of the appendix, the court does take into consideration all of the things Mr. Gardellini argued in support of a basis for departing from the guidelines. I do believe that those things, each and every one of them, is a basis for considering the 18 U.S.C. 3553 calculation. We had just spent 2 hours arguing. The defense attorney, the prosecutor, Mr. Gardellini, there was give and take with the judge during that 2 hours, and we had submitted a 27-page sentencing memorandum that outlined the points and the factors that we thought the trial judge should take into account in departing downward. The court had read that. He stated that. We're dealing with Judge Kennedy, who's been a member of this bench for almost 15 years. Before that, he was a member of the trial bench in the D.C. Superior Court for 15 years, an experienced judge. I see my time is up. If you have no further questions, I'll sit down. Thank you.
Mr. Hochman, I think you had about a minute left. We'll give you two.
Thank you very much. As this court showed in In Re Seal case decided recently, the court is struggling with the level of appellate review that the Booker, Rita, Kimbrough, and Gall cases command that this court should do on district courts. What we would suggest is that the Cutler court in the Second Circuit.
That was a case involving procedure, though.
Correct.
You don't have a procedural argument here. You just have a pure substantive argument.
Correct. I was actually more referring to your dissenting opinion in Re Seal case, where you actually addressed the substantive reasonableness of that particular case. And what the court is trying to say or looking for is what the due deference should be to a district court's discretion or the abuse of discretion. The court, and that being the Gall, Kimbrough, Rita, and Booker court, didn't say that we stop with procedural reasonableness. It could have. It could have literally said that and said, don't go to substantive reasonableness. It could have said that a district court has unbridled discretion between zero and the maximum to sentence wherever you want. But what the court said is you look at substantive reasonableness, and then to apply some flesh to that bone, the Cutler court said a range of reasonable sentences. The Martin court in the First Circuit talked about a range of permissible decisions. And what we would say in this case is that unsupervised probation in Belgium, and that's it, is outside the range of reasonable sentences. That this is the case, if not now, when? This is that case where we are outside the range of reasonable sentences, that there is no substantial restriction on this defendant's liberty, and it makes a mockery of deterrence. The court itself said that effectively. If this sentence does not deter, the prosecution does. And to the extent that deterrence has been focused on by the Sentencing Commission.
Do you think Gall was deterred by his sentence?
I think Gall was deterred.
Or the sentence in Gall deterred others, I mean.
I think to the extent that an individual would understand all the factors in Gall that resulted in that sentence, yes. In large part because of the withdrawal from the conspiracy.
Dealing gets you probation.
Well, no. But what it says is if you ecstasy deal for 7 months when you're 21 years old and you withdraw from the conspiracy voluntarily before law enforcement ever gets to you, and then you change your entire life, and when they first come in contact you, you admit it. You admit it. You cooperate. Yes, I would say that is what that sentence is encouraging everyone to do. Imagine if every drug dealer voluntarily withdrew from the drug conspiracy and then when approached by law enforcement, gave it up and then changed their life. This would be a different world. And yes, we should encourage that. And yes, that does promote respect for the law.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.